Exiled by Smaug, the dwarves of Erebor wander Middle-earth, seeking out a new home. Yet new perils and vicious foes seem to meet them wherever they turn. Meanwhile, Saruman convinces the White Council to delay an assault on Dol Guldur, and future heroes are born in the forgotten lands of the Northwest. Join us as we continue our exploration of the key events of the Third Age. The Tolkien Road, Episode 208, The Lord of the Rings, History of the Third Age, Part 6. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 208. Greta, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Super.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
On this episode, we'll be continuing our journey through the history of the Third Age as we look at key events from the years 2770 through 2941.
Nice.
Jam-packed.
Very much so.
Lots of interesting, fascinating things happened during this period leading up to the events of The Hobbit.
Right.
2941.
Yeah. So I remember I particularly enjoyed reviewing the material for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because names and everything began to be more familiar.
Yeah.
And events too, you know, because I think we've talked about we've talked about some of them previously on various podcast episodes.
Most definitely.
So anyway, it was just nice because I felt like I had more of a frame of reference for these events.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Lots of familiar names, places. Mm-hmm. It's starting to be like, okay, now I'm recognizing these things. Now I'm recognizing how this all fits together.
Right, exactly.
Well, before we dive in, let's take care of business. First off, we always have to give a shout out to our patrons,
mm-hmm.
our amazing, wonderful patrons. Thank you all who support the Tolkien Road financially.
Thank you.
Please support the Tolkien Road financially via Patreon if you do not already. Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road to find out more details on how to do so. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like early access to new episodes and more. So.
Great, great, great stuff.
That's right. Just do it. If you're unable to support us via Patreon, you can also support us via Tip Jar. So you can leave a tip on the website for a particular episode if you'd like. Always appreciated. And definitely you should subscribe, rate, and review. Right? Subscribe, rate, and review. Those three things. And whatever podcast platform app you're using, do all three of those things, right? And all three of those things are of kind of joint importance, right? All three of those things let the algorithms, let the computers, and let other people know that you think this is a worthy podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's basically like the trifecta
mm-hmm.
of podcast stuff.
That's right.
Podcast.
Yes.
Things. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. You got it. You're speaking the truth, Greta.
Oh, man. Okay.
Still, you know, just it's things still tend to be kind of quiet out there in the world of Tolkien news. We're, you know, we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for more news on Latron Prime. So I know we're all going to be very excited when we finally do get that, you know, get some big news items and start finding out a lot more about the show. And, you know, there's all the build up to it. But still pretty quiet out there. But if you do see something you find interesting, if you deem newsworthy, shoot us a tip, right? Go to the website via the contact form, TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com. Just let us know in whatever way you can find us that you think you saw something that seems worthy of mentioning.
Yeah, so, please do.
Yeah.
Because we'd like to hear all the things related to Tolkien.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence. And Greta... Ready.
Man, did I just get a new nickname?
I was going to say, Greta, are you ready? But maybe it was just like, are we ready?
Are we ready? Oh, maybe that's our new thing.
Greta, are you ready to dive in?
You know what? I am.
Let's do it.
Let's do this.
Okay, on this episode, we're discussing the events spanning Third Age 2770 through Third Age 2941. With Smaug's coming to Erebor, the dwarves are without a home and struggling to find their place in the world. The events of these 200 years lead up to the events of The Hobbit, and important things happen for Rohan and Gondor in this period as well. So,
It sounded very scripted.
Trying to say something?
I'm sorry. Maybe you should let me read it next time. I think I can make it sound a little bit more interesting.
Just go for it. You go for it then yourself.
Oh, like right now?
Sure,
just
why
repeat
not?
It?
We'll let the listeners vote.
Oh, all right. Here we go. Hey, friends. On this episode, we're discussing the events spanning Third Age 2770.
Already screwed up.
I'm starting over.
I'm not editing this, by the way.
That's fine. I'm going to do it perfect this time. Hey, friends. On this episode, we're discussing the event spanning Third Age 2770 to Third Age 2941. With Smaug's coming to Erebor, the dwarves are without a home and struggling to find their place in the world. The events of these 200 years lead up to the events of The Hobbit, and important things happen for Rohan and Gondor in this period as well. Boom.
Only took you two takes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Still, better than what you did.
Okay. Well,
if... Cast your vote, people.
Cast your vote, right? Correspondence. Maybe we'll put it, maybe we'll set up a poll on Patreon for this, or on the, you know, on the Facebook page. So,
okay.
Or maybe you can just tell us who you vote for. You can just correspond with us and tell us who you vote for.
Sounds good. Just a little friendly competition. Never hurt anybody.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My feelings might be hurt.
Well, maybe it'll encourage you to up your game.
So 2790. So, let's see.
We said 2777.
2770.
Yes.
You said 2707.
7770.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Saruman, at the end of the last episode, Smaug descended on Erebor, right? So this is everything that happens after that. So 2790, Thror slain by an orc in Moria, and the dwarves gather for a war of vengeance. Also, the birth of Garantius, later known as the Old Took. So, first off, Thror, we're all aware, Thror is the grandfather of Thorin Oakenshield.
Right.
And he was the last king under the mountain before, before Thorin,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So Thror, he, you know, after they leave Erebor in 2770, they're all kind of, the dwarves are wandering about, and Thror, let me just read the entry so you have a little more background on this. So, in Dunland, it says, his people tried to make a living, but 20 years after the sack of Erebor, despondent and homeless, Thror left his people and went north with a single companion, Nar. Before leaving, Thror gave his son Thrain II his ring of power, along with the map and key to the Lonely Mountain. Thror wished to see the fabled city of his ancestors, Khazad-dûm. So eventually they made it over the Redhorn Pass into Azanulbazar, the Dimrill Dale. Coming to the east gate of Moria, Thror found it open. Nar begged him to beware, but ignoring his companion, Thror walked through the gates as the heir who had returned, but he did not come back. So let's see. It turns out Nar hid nearby for many days until he saw Thror's body flung down the steps. His severed head lay face downward on the ground. As he knelt there, Nar saw branded across his forehead in dwarvish runes the name Azog. This orc then threw a small purse of coins at him, calling him a beggar. Nar fled, weeping down the silver load, while orcs emerged and hacked Thor's body into pieces and fed them to the crows. So, pretty ignominious death there for...
gruesome, definitely.
Yeah, for Thror, who was once the king under the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So, Thror... So the dwarves, after leaving Erebor, go to, you know, they try to make a go of it in Dunland, which again is this, you know, region on the western side of the south, kind of the south end of the Misty Mountains, really not too far from where Moria is, where Khazad-dûm was, and all things considered. So it's not too surprising that he maybe tried to make a venture there and see if there was some chance they could, you know, restart Khazad-dûm, because it's been like 800 years since the dwarves held Khazad-dûm. But yeah, 2790, the dwarves also gather for a war of vengeance. And so in 2793, the war of the dwarves and the orcs begins. However, let's pause right there and look up the Old Took, right? This is a figure that is mentioned sometimes in the Lord of the Rings,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
By the hobbits. He's this known figure. So his name is Garantius Took, also known as the Old Took, was a renowned hobbit and 26th Thane of the Shire. So again, we found out, I think on last episode, that the Took family had become the Thanes, right, around the, it was either the 10th or the 13th, I can't remember which one. So here Garantius, that's who we're talking about when we talk about the Old Took. He died at age 130 years old. So, this is when he was born, 2790. So 2920 would have been when he died. And, so you can understand why maybe even in the late 2900s and early 3000s, younger hobbits like Frodo and Merry and Pippin and Sam would have been familiar with at least kind of the legend of the Old Took. There were other hobbits who were alive at that time, older hobbits who would have known the Old Took and remembered the Old Took.
Right.
So, 2793, this War of the Dwarves and the Orcs. All right. So, this seems to have been in response to the death of Thror, the murder of Thror. Of course, we know that in 2770, the dwarves left Erebor after it was sacked by...
Smacked.
That's what it was. It was smacked by
his giant tail.
You got a Smaug smack,
right? I did.
So they leave there, and then we just heard what happened to Thror in 2790. And then in 2793, the dwarven host was ready and departed for war, assailing and sacking all the orc holds they could find, from Mount Gundabad in the north to the Gladden in the south, one by one.
So they're on the war path.
Yeah.
They were wanting to avenge the death of their king.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, the dwarves respond. This was a response to the to the death of Thror. So they're out for blood. They're out for vengeance, mm-hmm. and all of this. And then it lasts for 6 years. The war came to a climax in 2799 when the final battle was fought in the Dimrill Dale below the East Gate of Moria, the Battle of Azanulbazar. The dwarves gained victory in this notoriously bloody encounter when reinforcements arrived late on the scene from the Iron Hills. Azog was slain by Dane Ironfoot.
Is this the battle that they... Weren't there like...
They depict this in the Hobbit films.
Right, okay.
In like flashbacks,
okay,
right?
That's... Yes, okay.
Yeah, and I believe it's the battle where he earned the title, where Thorin earned the title Oakenshield. Let's see, Thrain the Second himself lost an eye and gained a limp, and Thorin was wounded when his shield broke, and he had to use an oak branch to defend himself, hence the epithet Oakenshield.
Oakenshield.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Very cool.
So, that's the War of Dwarves and Orcs. This battle of Nanduhirion before the East Gate of Moria, that's another name for the battle of... Azanulbazar.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay, so they're one and the same.
They are the same battle.
No, get out.
What does the name Nanduhirion mean? Let's see here. The web page does not want to cooperate.
Silence.
There we go. Let's see. It doesn't. It may just be another word for Dimrill Dale or Azanulbazar in a different language or something like that.
Okay.
So.
Cool.
Yeah. And then we also have the, at this point, so after this battle, after the end of the War of the Dwarves and the Orcs, the dwarves, including Thrain and his son Thorin, wander westwards and eventually settle in the Arid Luin, of course, which are the Blue Mountains, the remnant of the Blue Mountains, famously being the eastern border of Beleriand in the First Age, and only part of them still exist in the Second and Third Ages, and they border... really the, in the far west, the realm of Lindon, right, which is ruled by Círdan.
Right.
So, yeah, where the Grey Havens are located and all that good stuff. So that is kind of the long story of how, or the short version of how Thorin...
The short version of the long story.
The short version of the long story of how Thrain and Thorin came to... the Blue Mountains, mm-hmm. right? Came to reside in the Blue Mountains for a while.
Gotcha.
So, 2800 through 64, orcs from the north trouble Rohan, King Walda slain by them. So, a long period, right? A long period to be troubled by orcs.
Yeah, 64 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
I would not want to be troubled by orcs at all, and definitely not for 64 years.
64 years, no.
And one of the things we discovered in the last episode was that after the long winter, it was really hard for the Rohirrim to recover, right? They took a big hit in that, mm-hmm. and that's how Saruman eventually came to Isengard, because it was hoped that he could help the Rohirrim regain some of their strength. But this is only, you know, this period of the troubles with the orcs from the north is only about 40 years after the end of the long winter. So
they didn't have much time to...
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, maybe rebuild. Saruman hadn't done a great job of helping them. Right?
Doesn't sound like it.
Which
no.
is kind of what we would expect, knowing well, how Saruman yeah. turns out.
And knowing his motives, yeah.
Yeah, he may have been looking upon them more as his, you know, as his vassals than like these people that he was, you know, there to help and that sort of thing. We don't have any indication of this from right here, but, you know, one may wonder. So, 2841. Oh, wait, King Walda, let's see. He's mentioned here. Walda was the son of Britta Leofa. He served in his father's army fighting off the orcs which had attempted to invade Rohan during Britta's reign. He became king after the death of his father in Third Age 2842, and at the time of his coronation it was believed Rohan had been freed of them. However, some orcs remained, and in 2851, after ruling just 9 years, he was killed by an orc in Dunharrow. His son Fulka succeeded and avenged him. So, that's who Walda is. Yeah.
Alrighty then.
Alrighty.
So while all that's going on, while Rohan's being besieged by orcs, there's mm-hmm. like a lot of stuff going on in other places.
Yes. So that 2864 is the orcs and the Rohan, and then 2841 is Thrain the Second setting out. He sets out to visit Erebor, but is pursued by the servants of Sauron. Right. So he's.
So this would be Thorin's dad.
Right. He's trying to make his way back to. Mm-hmm. To the Lonely Mountain from the Blue Mountains, which is a long, very long journey, right? Mm-hmm. So even longer. He starts out even further west than Bilbo and the dwarves would have started out from the Shire when they went to Erebor. But he is pursued by the servants of Sauron. So
I guess he doesn't get very far.
Right, right. Well, it says 2845, Thrain the Dwarf is imprisoned in Dol Guldur. The last of the Seven Rings is taken from him.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me to think, like, why was it important for them to take this ring back? Why wouldn't they have wanted him to maybe keep it? And, you know, then Sauron maybe could do, well, I guess the whole thing with the dwarves was they weren't very good, easy to control for Sauron, even with their rings and his one ring, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had a mind of their own.
Maybe he felt like it made the dwarves too powerful to have the ring. So he loses the ring, and he winds up in Dol Guldur. He winds up imprisoned in Dol Guldur. 2850. Let's see. 2850, Gandalf again enters Dol Guldur and discovers that its master is indeed Sauron, who is gathering all the rings and seeking for news of the One and of Isildur's heir. He finds Thrain and receives the key of Erebor. Thrain dies in Dol Guldur. Of course, so this is good background for the Hobbit.
Right. Right. Is this also... He also receives the map at this point, doesn't he?
Does he receive the map as well? I think... I think that Thorin has the map.
Okay.
Yeah, because...
So was it just the key? Because there was something that Gandalf got from Thrain, that Thorin was like, how did you get this? And that's when he tells him about meeting his dad in Dol Guldur. But...
Yeah.
I thought it was the map. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think it's the key, right? It's the key that... Gandalf.
Oh, that opens the...
Right. The key they're referring to here, right?
Gotcha.
The key of Erebor. So...
Speak, friend, and you shall...
No.
No,
that's,
I'm getting it all
that's,
confused.
That's the entrance to Moria on the west side, right?
Okay.
Speak, friend, and enter. That's... You're thinking of Lord of the Rings. And the Hobbit, they've got the runes, right, that tell them...
Oh, yeah, with,
like the last, you know, the whatever the riddle is, but...
yes, okay.
Something about the last sunset door or something like that.
Okay, so Thorin had the map, but without the key, it was basically useless.
Right.
And so he gets the key from Gandalf. Who got it from Thrain. Got it. Okay.
Thanks yeah.
for setting me straight.
Yeah, so, like I said, I'm pretty sure that the map, let's see, where is the map? Thorin and the dwarves were not convinced. It was not until Gandalf revealed Thor's map and key. Okay, so he did. Okay, I was wrong. He did. I guess Gandalf did have the map as well, although the key is just just the key is mentioned here.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're just like, you know, they go together.
Yeah.
So.
So, there you go. However, Thorin and the dwarves were not convinced. It was not until Gandalf revealed Thor's map and key that Thorin was convinced that the quest would be profitable to him. So. And the runes are here. Stand by the gray stone when the thrush knocks and the setting sun with the last light of Durin's day will shine upon the keyhole.
That's right. Yes. Okay.
Right.
It's all coming back to me now.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Cool.
Yep. All right.
But then Thrain dies, and that's sad.
Yes, Thrain dies after Gandalf is able to receive these things from him and rescue him. I have to think Gandalf and walking into Dol Guldur in 2850 is like, Sauron again? Right?
Can't get rid of this guy.
I thought I kicked you out.
Yep.
Right?
It's like a pesky flea.
Yeah.
That just keeps coming back.
Well.
Even though you keep swatting it away.
Yep. I think Gandalf probably would have been like, I'm so over this by now.
I'm over being over this.
Over you.
I'm over it.
Over it, Sauron.
Over it. Just go away.
Go back to Mordor.
Go back to your hole in the ground.
2851, the White Council meets. Gandalf urges an attack on Dol Guldur. Saruman overrules him. Sauron begins to search near the Gladden Fields. Right. So... the footnote here says, "And it afterwards became clear that Saruman had then begun to desire to possess the One Ring himself, and he hoped that it might reveal itself, seeking its master if Sauron were let be for a time."
It's kind of crazy to me that he was able to deceive Gandalf and the White Council for as long as he did.
Yeah.
It seems like they would have seen through him before this.
Well...
Like, I know I he's, think... like, charming and wizardly and everything, but...
Well, yeah, but one of his like spiritual powers seems to have been the ability to like be convincing and
like Jedi mind tricks,
almost, right?
Yeah,
almost. You know, there's that this you know, the scene after the battle of you know, after the bout his defeat at Isengard when they're still in the tower and they're like, and Gandalf has to warn them all about like not conversing. Like, not getting into conversations with him, right? Because he is so... it's easy to lose your... Like, to kind of lose your mind, and he can kind of... He has a way of, like, casting a spell on you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that probably applies even to very powerful people like Gandalf and Galadriel and Elrond and Círdan, right?
Yeah, probably.
So...
I mean, you'd think they'd be a little bit more resilient, but...
But he's a Maiar, though,
he's
right?
He's a Maiar. He's still greater than that.
I mean, Gandalf is probably the one that has the ability to see through him best.
Right.
But Saruman begins to search near the Gladden Fields all at the same time. So Saruman, at this point, seems to be plotting, right? He's kind of going out on his own and thinking, okay, how can I spend this to gain power for myself, right? How can I...
what is he looking for?
In the Gladden Fields?
Yeah. The ring?
Yeah,
is that
the
what
ring,
he's looking
the one
for?
Ring, right.
Okay, I feel like he should know that it was taken by Sméagol.
Why would he know that?
Because doesn't he, like, he's connected to Sauron, who knows all?
Well, I don't know. Is he at this point? I'm
Maybe
not sure.
Maybe not. I don't know. It just seems like he should know. Like he should just have an intuition.
He may have started using the Palantir at this point. But you know, I mean, it's not like Saruman was bad from the beginning, right? He was corrupted over time, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he's still pretty full of mixed motives here. And, anyway, it's an interesting question. Another one of many questions and, you know, Saruman being a figure we could do a long deep dive on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It just seems like it just seems beneath him.
Saruman is a he's a politician.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can see that.
He totally is. He's always trying to game the system, and he's unprincipled, except insofar as gaining more, retaining the power he has and gaining more power, right? Right. He wants, you know, he's, you know, you can kind of think of him like, almost like the Frank Underwood character from House of Cards, right? You know, he's just always trying to, he doesn't really seem to stand for anything except for his own survival and gain.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So it's never 100% clear whether he completely defects to Sauron's side. Because you kind of get the sense that, like, if he could best Sauron, he would, but not to free everybody else for his own gain.
Right.
And if he can't, then he's going to be Sauron's best friend, right?
Yep.
You know, this is just the kind of operator that Saruman seems to be, or at least seems to become over time in Middle-earth after his arrival in the Third Age, early in the Third Age. All right. 2851. I'm sorry, we already talked about that. 2872. Beleg-Thor.
52.
2872. What does it say in yours?
2852.
Interesting. It says...
Does it say 2872 in yours?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's a scandal.
Yours is right. Let's see. Yeah, mine's right. Beleg-Thor, the second of Gondor, dies in 2872. The White Tree also dies, and no seedling can be found. The Dead Tree is left standing. So Beleg-Thor is, of course, another steward. He's the latest steward at this point of Gondor. And I tried to figure out why the White Tree dies. But
yeah, I was going to ask.
I couldn't really figure it out. Maybe he was the last, like, worthy steward of Gondor. I don't know. But yeah, it dies. So
and it's not poisoned or chopped or anything.
No, it's so left standing. Yeah, it's left standing. So I, you know, the White Trees are a topic I would love. I would like to do a deep dive on actually sooner rather than later because I think there's some good lore to explore there.
Yeah,
right,
for sure.
Let's see. 2885, stirred up by emissaries of Sauron, the Haradrim cross the Poros and attack Gondor. The sons of Folkwine of Rohan are slain in the service of Gondor. So, Folkwine. Let's see who Folkwine is.
They're from Rohan.
Yes.
Or he is from Rohan.
He was the 14th king of Rohan. Folkwine was the son of Folka and great-grandfather of Theoden.
Oh.
Aided by Gondor, he drove out Dunlendings, who occupied the area between the Adorn and Isen, and recovered that area. In Third Age 2085, he also fulfilled the oath of Yoril and sent many Rohirrim to the aid of Gondor against the Haradrim. However, his twin sons, Fulkred and Fastred, were both killed in the war, and Folkwine was succeeded by his youngest child, Fingal.
With an E.
No, with an F.
What? I'm looking at the wrong one.
Yeah, Fingal.
Oh, Fingal.
His son, Fingal, has a son named Fingal.
Oh, that's not confusing at all.
Yeah, well.
Fingal begets Fingal.
Yeah, and then Theoden.
Okay.
After that.
Huh. Well, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on.
Okay.
The most exciting thing ever happens in 2890.
Bilbo born in the Shire. That's right.
Bilbo is born.
Yeah. And this is 51 years before the events of The Hobbit. So Bilbo is 51 years old in The Hobbit. There you go. 2901. Most of the remaining inhabitants of Ithilien deserted owing to the attacks of Uruks of Mordor. The secret refuge of Hinnith Anun is built. So the Hinnith Anun. So Ithilien is this region, you know, where Minas Ithil was, right? It's the eastern side of the Anduin in Gondor, right? And of course, this is where Frodo and Sam are captured by Faramir and company when Frodo and Sam are trying to journey to the pass of Cirith Ungol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's that whole episode where they, you know, Faramir and company discover Gollum, and they're about, you know, they want to take him out and everything like that, and they don't. And so this, that all happens in Ithilien, and I believe this location, Henith Annun, is that place, right? It's that, it's kind of that secret hideout. So Henith Annun was a hidden Gondorian outpost northeast of Cair Andros and North Ithilien. During the War of the Ring, Faramir, son of Steward Denethor II, had his base of operations there, and Frodo Baggins and Samwise Gamgee were taken there by his company.
That's where that really pretty waterfall is, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a pretty secret place. Mm-hmm. Henith Annun is also known as Window of the Sunset and Window on the West, which are its translations in Sindarin.
Hmm. Yeah. Lovely.
Mm-hmm.
But it's deserted at this point because it keeps getting attacked.
Ithilien, all of that region is,
oh,
right?
That whole
Ithilien,
region. Okay.
Right?
Oh, and that's why they built that secret refuge,
mm-hmm.
was to hide from the bad guys.
Yeah, because, you know, so Osgiliath fell a while back, was abandoned a while back, and mm-hmm. so Osgiliath was kind of the main crossing point between the Anduin from the west of Gondor into the east of Gondor into Ithilien. But now, you know, Ithilien essentially becomes a wilderness, right? There's, you know, who would want to live there, because it seems the forces of Mordor are free to do what they will in that region.
Yeah.
Right.
And nobody wants a part of that. That's for
nope.
sure.
Okay.
2907.
Yeah. 2907, birth of Gilrion, mother of Aragorn the second. Right, so this is our Aragorn.
So is that the Aragorn?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that is the Aragorn we all know and love. The,
and his mom
the future
is
king, Gilrion.
Gilrion.
Yeah.
And what is is she descended from?
Gilrion
that we know.
Well, let's see here. She was born in the year 2907 of the Third Age. She wanted to marry Arathorn the Second, the chieftain of the Dúnedain, but her father at first did not want her did not want her partly because she was at the time younger than customary for marriage, and he also foresaw that Arathorn would have a short life.
Okay.
But as far as your question,
I don't recognize any of those names.
Yeah, she was the daughter of Eivorwen and Gilbarad, and then granddaughter of Gilbarad.
Okay.
So I don't know, neither of those names mean anything to me, but yeah, maybe some other time we'll figure it out. Her name means netted or enlaced star.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. So Aragorn's royal lineage
mm-hmm.
comes from his dad's side.
Yes. Right? Yeah. His dad would be
Arathorn. Yeah.
Arathorn, mm-hmm. and is, you know, descendant from the
right.
kings of Arnor.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So. They're all in the line of Isildur.
Isildur.
Yeah.
Yes, got it. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so 2911, the fell winter, the Barad-dûr and other rivers are frozen, white wolves invade Eriador from the north. So.
Oh, this reminds me, this is something I wanted to ask,
mm-hmm.
I guess this kind of relates to this too, but so this is the fell winter, and then I think, was it the last episode we talked about
the long winter? Yeah.
Were those in any way, do we know that, were they brought on by Sauron or any, like, was it caused by evil forces, or was it just kind of a fluky, yeah?
Well, you could argue that all such weather goes back all the way to Ainulindale when Melkor vowed to make war upon Ulmo's creations, right? When he vowed to create both the extreme heat and the utter cold, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So
that is true.
But I don't think it's any like magic of Sauron.
It's not
or anything
okay,
like
that's
that.
I guess what I was wondering.
I could be wrong, but I don't know of any reference that
okay.
claims that. So
okay.
good question though. But the fell winter, it began in November of 2911. Sauron was not able to launch a full attack, as the war of the dwarves and orcs of a full century earlier had eliminated most of the orcs in the north, and the Haradrim had been badly defeated in 2885. The winter was also less harsh than the long winter, and snow and ice stopped in Eriador at the Grey Flood and in Wilderland in the middle of Mirkwood. Nevertheless, there were severe problems, as food again ran short, and the hobbits of the Shire were attacked by white wolves, which crossed the frozen Brandywine River. It was on this occasion that the horn call of Buckland had been sounded. It was not heard again until Black Riders invaded Buckland in 3018. Gandalf and the Rangers of the North had to provide food for the hobbits to prevent them from dying of hunger. So, the horn call of Buckland. Interesting. Yeah. In March, when the winter ended, great floods of meltwater rushed down Greyflood, and the city of Tharbad was ruined and its bridge broken. The people of Enidwaith also suffered greatly as their lands were flooded. So, that's the fell winter for you.
Gotcha.
Sounds pretty fell.
It does sound very fell.
2912, great floods devastate Enidwaith and Minhiriath. Tharbad is ruined and deserted. So this...
That's what you just read.
Yeah, and I'm... Well, it was in this... It was on the article I was referencing.
That's what I meant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
These regions are actually over here in the, like, southeast of Eriador, right? This
Way far west.
Minhiriath and Enidwaith, right? So south of the Shire, well south of the Shire, and down on the coast of Eriador in the southern part of Eriador. So, yeah. Let's see, 2920, the death of the old Took, who we talked about earlier. 2929, Arathorn, son of Arador of the Dúnedain, weds Gilrion. 2930, Arador...
Which means...
What?
That she was 22.
Yes, there you go.
Which I'm surprised. Well, I guess that would have been young marrying age for people that lived a long time.
No, I mean, I don't think it...
Well, that's what they said. They actually didn't...
Well, I think that's maybe... You could argue... The point of that was they didn't want her to get married too young, right? So, but I think 22 back then would have been a pretty old age to get married.
Would it? I guess maybe.
I feel like in olden times, it was much more common to be like married in your younger teens. Yeah.
Well, like, yeah, I guess I feel like this is different. But when they said that, when you read that her dad didn't want her to get married because she was below the typical marrying age, I thought it meant that she was like a teenager. But she wasn't a teenager.
Well,
she was 22.
But she may not have gotten married until later because maybe she wanted to get married before then, right? Like, that's the point I'm making, right?
Oh, before 29.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's what you're saying. All right.
2930, Arador slain by trolls, birth of Denethor II, son of Ecthelion II, and Minas Tirith, right? So this is the Denethor of Lord of the Rings. Arador is, again, is the father of Arathorn, right? So the grandfather of Aragorn, right? And he is slain, so we find out he's slain by trolls. By the way, this line that Aragorn is part of, there is the chieftain of the Dúnedain. So Arador is the 14th chieftain of the Dúnedain, which makes Arathorn the 2nd, the 15th, and then Aragorn the 16th. So there's still this kind of like lineage, this recognized like important office or hereditary office, if you will, that they're a part of. It's just not really recognized that they're the king of Arnor anymore.
Gotcha. Right? Okay.
So, let's see, where did I leave? Oh yeah, 2931, Aragorn, son of Arathorn II, born on March 1st of that year. 2933, Arathorn II slain, so Aragorn is only 2 years old when his father is slain. Gilrion takes Aragorn to Imladris. Elrond receives him as foster son and gives him the name Estel, which means hope. His ancestry is concealed. 2939, Saruman discovers that Sauron's servants are searching the Anduin... are searching the Anduin near Gladden Fields, and that Sauron therefore has learned of Isildur's end. He is alarmed but says nothing to the council. So, again, Saruman, was he good guy, bad guy at this point? You know, kind of a mix, and really kind of maneuvering and plotting his own thing, and he conceals this important news from the rest of the council, which is a really bad development there, right? Because they're supposed to be able to trust each other for the good of Middle-earth. And once you start concealing important things like that from the people who need to be your trusted allies, then you start driving a wedge between you and them. So
Sauron actually starts searching the Gladden Fields after Saruman does. That's interesting to me.
But no, it just means that Saruman discovers that Sauron's servants are doing it, right? It doesn't mean that they hadn't been doing it before that year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because we did talk about Saruman searching them.
We talked about Saruman doing it. But
right, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
So, we talked about Saruman doing it, and now it's Sauron's servants doing it.
Yeah.
That Saruman discovers that. Okay.
Yeah, Saruman discovers that Sauron's servants are doing it.
And he doesn't say anything, which is not good.
Not good.
Nope.
Not good. All right, and then 2941, of course, the events of The Hobbit, all recounted there. Thorin, Oakenshield, and Gandalf visit Bilbo in the Shire. Bilbo meets Smeagol, Gollum, and finds the ring. The White Council meets. Saruman agrees to an attack on Dol Guldur, since he now wishes to prevent Sauron from searching the river. Sauron, having made his plans, abandons Dol Guldur. The Battle of the Five Armies in Dale, death of Thorin II, Bard of Esgaroth slays Smaug, Dane of the Iron Hills becomes king under the mountain, as Dain II. So
if you don't feel like reading the whole Hobbit, you can just... Yeah, there you go.
There you go. There's the, there's the summary. The short version.
The very short version.
All right. Yeah.
Cool.
So with Erebor restored, things are looking up for the free peoples of Middle-earth for the first time in many years. Next time, we'll take a look at the events spanning the years between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
I know, things are real good, right? Like, they seem real good. I mean, Smaug is dead, right? And Erebor has been restored. I mean, hunky-dory. What else could, like, what could possibly go wrong now?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, it seems like everything's all settled.
Yeah, well.
Peace.
Not for long.
Not for long.
Mm-hmm. Sauron's always plotting, as is Saruman, apparently. So,
nope.
Can't trust those Maia.
Nope.
Except for Gandalf.
Only Gandalf and Radagast.
Well, yeah, kind of. I don't know if I really said I trust Radagast. I mean, like, you know, I don't think he's going to harm me, but.
Yeah. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Gandalf's definitely the most trustworthy one in every respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You want Gandalf on your side.
Always.
Mm-hmm. All right, correspondence time.
Woo-woo.
We got some great correspondence to bring your way this week. First off, we've got a brief comment from David B. that he left on the website. Let's see if I can bring the right one up here. Yeah, not this one. Let's see. Not that that one's unworthy. I'm just, I guess we had several on 828. Here we go. All right, David, commenting on episode 205, The Lord of the Rings, History of the Third Age, Part 3. David said, "You mentioned some of the hobbits living in the Angle before moving on to what would become the Shire. In Europe, Anglia was a kingdom in what is now Denmark. It was from there that people moved into Britain, becoming the Anglo and Anglo-Saxon. In Old English, Anglia was Anglaland, if I remember correctly. It's close, if not exact."
That's interesting.
Always some cool little philology and history of language tips.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I'm always interested to learn these things. I think I've said it before on the podcast, but I had the opportunity to take a history of the English language class as part of my master's degree, mm-hmm. master's work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe the most interesting college course I've ever taken, right?
I remember when you were taking it, you shared a lot of the stuff you were learning, and it was very interesting.
It's a truly fascinating topic, mm-hmm. and you learn so much. In fact, I'd argue that through a good history of language course, you learn more about the history of something than like of a place or an mm-hmm. ethnic group
Not just
or something
language.
Like that.
Yeah.
Than you thought, because there's so many different streams that converge to give you the modern form of the language. So
mm-hmm.
anyway.
And you think about just how much language is reflective of culture
mm-hmm.
and in locales and all that kind of stuff.
All that jazz.
So, yeah. So it's really fascinating
Absolutely.
How it all works together.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for that comment, David.
Yes. Thank you, David.
Next up, we have a note from Joey from August 26th. Joey says, and this is in, he left this comment on episode 76, which was on a Akalabaeth way back in the day. I think maybe we talked about Balrogs in this episode. It sounds like he's more responding to the films, but anyway, I'm going to read his comment. He says, "After hearing both sides about the films, I agree with both. There are some scenes in the movie that I feel could have been better. It's hard to include all details from a book, though, without it being 5+ hours. Overall, Jackson did a good job. I also agree with Josh about the Balrog. It was a huge demonic creature with plenty of shadow and flame. I'm just going to pause there. I'm not sure if... you know what? He's probably talking about Superfan Josh, who we haven't heard from in a long time.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, for a second I thought he got my name wrong, but then I realized, oh, he's probably talking about Superfan
Josh. Right, because Josh joined us on one of them.
Yeah, for one of those episodes. That's right. It was probably the one for Fellowship, actually, way back in the day, which is the one with the Balrog in it.
Oh, right. Yeah. That makes sense.
So,
yeah.
Hey, shout out to Josh S. if you're listening. Drop us a line, man.
Yeah, where are you?
Josh is in Star Wars world, right? That's, you know, yeah. Star Wars is his first love.
That's
so
true.
He's hanging out over there, but I hope he'll drop us a line if he's listening.
Yeah, please do.
Anyway, continue with Joey's note. Joey says, it was a huge demonic creature with plenty of shadow and flame. I can imagine 20 plus Balrogs like that attacking in the Silmarillion, and it's exactly what I would want them to look like. Could they be a little darker with more shadow? Sure. But if you recall, at first seen in the movie, the Balrog is darker and does not enhance its flames until at the bridge. So who's to say that they could not control their appearance on command or for certain situations, and we just saw a small glimpse of that in the film? I mean, they are fallen Maia, after all. These guys had serious dark powers. I think it's worth considering. It's all a matter of opinion anyways, and no matter how it was portrayed, someone will have an issue with the final product. I see where you're coming from. I'm just not one that was disappointed. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. I think if I were, you know, this was a long time ago that I was that I may have expressed my own views on this. I think overall, like, it's not like a huge sticking point for me. I think it's just more of a, in comparing it to the way it's described in the book. And, it's not like it's a blight on the film or anything like
right,
that.
Right, right, right.
In fact, I'm with you. I think it's kind of cool overall. Mm-hmm. I maybe would have wanted it to be a little less like, you know, there's some things that maybe seem a little bit cliche, demonic kind of, you know, mm-hmm. with like the big horns and everything.
Right, yeah.
But
would you have wanted it to be like more nebulous? Like,
yeah.
With less form?
More nebulous and just like kind of brooding and menacing, right? Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
But... I feel Joey too here. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm with him. So
yeah.
Joey, good points. And I'm not going to say that I like hardcore disagree with you or anything, but you're right. It's just like we can have kind of differences of opinion on how the best way to portray this.
Yeah,
so.
It's such a subjective issue anyway.
Most
like
def.
All movies are. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that note, Joey.
Yeah, good thoughts.
Great
Thanks.
To hear from you. The next is from Michael from August 21st. Michael writes, and this is a comment on episode 193, which was The Hobbit, The Last Chapters, Part 2, A Well-Planned Party. So this was, of course, when we looked at that first rewritten chapter of The Hobbit when Tolkien was thinking he might rewrite the whole book. Michael says, I like the idea that perhaps Bilbo has reframed the trauma of his experience as a fantasy that is appropriate for even children to read. But the second version is written more soberly by Gandalf himself. Much like Tolkien may have distilled his experience as fantasy in 1937, a more naive hobbit, the younger Tolkien, wrote something less candid than a wizened Gandalf, mm-hmm. older Tolkien. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's fun to think about that, you know, that with that, you know, that maybe the Hobbit reflects this younger version of Bilbo and his mm-hmm. telling of the story mm-hmm. as opposed to a later version, you know, when he's like had more time to reflect and maybe speak with Gandalf about more things, and Gandalf maybe mm-hmm. has had more of an editing hand and everything.
Right. So. And also just how an older Tolkien's perspective would have changed.
Yeah.
Over time.
Absolutely.
As opposed to that of his younger self.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good stuff, Michael.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank
Great
you.
To hear from you. All right. Next up, we have a note from, let's see, actually, let me clean that up a little bit. There we go. All right. Our next note is a short one from Monique S. Monique says, in response to episode 202, which was with Connor Sweeney on Abiding the Long Defeat, she says, thank you so much. This is so timely. In a broken world, it is good to be reminded of where our strength lies.
Mm.
Yeah. So that was a big theme of that episode on the Long Defeat and this, you know, exploring what Tolkien meant by this idea of the Long Defeat.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So I'm glad that was felt timely to you. And I hope it felt timely to others as well, Monique. So,
I mean, it's always a great reminder, but mm-hmm. especially now in what we've been going through these last several months.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Next up is Vite, Veit N, I believe, and again, I believe I'm saying your name correctly, Veit. Veit says, and I couldn't remember if I'd already read this one or not on a previous episode, but I kind of, my system may have failed me here, and I may be rereading one I've already read, but it was a good note, so I thought I'd read it. He says, "Hi, John. Hi, Greta. First, thanks for your podcast." You're welcome. I discovered it about a year ago, started listening. I've known the Tolkien universe from before, but came back to reading The Silmarillion just now. I've just finished Ainulin Dele and Valaquenta, and alongside listened to the respective Talking Tolkien episodes way back in the day for us.
That's a throwback.
Yep. So sorry to throw you back to the beginning of your road a few years ago by dropping some thoughts I had when reading, listening. And maybe, probably, meanwhile, you came across similar ideas like me and even talked about it in public. The three different themes of the Ainur. Okay, the first one is just for practice, right? The second and third, however, remind me of what astrophysics see in the Big Bang when our universe emerged. The music sung by the nice Ainur is the singularity. Everything nice, plain, harmonic. But nothing moves. It needs Melkor to represent the disturbance that brings instability to it, shaping the music that becomes Ea later on. I don't know when Tolkien collected his ideas of the Ainulin Dele, but if he had something similar in mind, he was quite close to the beginnings of the theories that are still somewhat valid today. Fascinating, peculiar, uncanny, at least. In your Ainulin Dele episode, you talk about the void of the imperishable flame. I'm reading in German, so I always have to retranslate, but I don't find the phrasing you're referring to. What I read instead, and what makes more sense to me, to be honest, is that Iluvatar and the Ainur bring the imperishable flame into the void. Would you agree? Melkor went searching for the void in the void for the imperishable flame. The vision developed in the void. And before creating Ea, Iluvatar says something like, "I will send the imperishable flame into the void and it will burn in the heart of the world." Or did I just misunderstand you in the episode? Then please ignore that thought. So, you know, I don't, it's been so long that it's hard to speak back to that. And I don't really have a habit of going back and listening to old episodes. It's uncomfortable when you've recorded things in the past to go back and listen to them most of the time. So
it is,
especially when we were such newbies at it, but I'm just going to see if I can find imperishable flame in here so I can read what it actually says in my, at least in English. And I think Veit said he's reading in German.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I believe we talked about this imperishable flame, or is that what it's called? Yeah. We talked about that at some point recently too, right? Like when we were going, when we were doing our more recent episodes on the early third age.
Okay.
Weren't we, when we were going through the timeline?
Yeah. And I think in reference to Gandalf.
Oh, okay.
Right. So,
gotcha.
So let's see. The first thing with the flame imperishable is that Iluvatar says to the Ainur that he has kindled them with the flame imperishable. You shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. Let's see. And then we've got... it says, Melkor had gone often alone into the void places seeking the imperishable flame, for desire grew hot within him to bring into being things of his own, and it seemed to him that Iluvatar took no thought for the void, and he was impatient of its emptiness. And the next thing is, when Iluvatar says, Ea, let these things be, and I will send forth into the void the flame imperishable, and it shall be at the heart of the world, and the world shall be, and those of you that will may go down into it. So, it seems like the flame imperishable is this thing that gives, it's like the life fire, right? That Iluvatar alone can give to something, right? So he has to give it to the Ainur, and he has to give it to the world that's created. So, and Melkor does go searching for the, it says, for the imperishable flame, right? Let's go back to that. He had gone often alone into the void places seeking the imperishable flame, for desire grew hot within him to bring into things being of his own. So back to Veit, he says, what I read is that Iluvatar and the Ainur bring the imperishable flame into the void. It sounds like Iluvatar places it into the void when he says, Ea, let these things be. Melkor went searching for the void for the imperishable flame before that. The vision developed in the void. And so, and before creating Ea, Ilúvatar says something like, I will send before creating Ea. Yeah. So I don't know. Like, it looks like there is a, you know, there's a sequence here where Melkor goes looking for it mm-hmm. in the void. Mm-hmm. And then Ilúvatar grants the vision, right? He says, let these things be. And he kind of foreshadows that I will send the flame into the world, right? Into mm-hmm. this world that I'm creating. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I think you're right, Veit, with your comments. So maybe we had it a little bit turned around and backwards on that in those first few episodes. I did write my book on this, on Anilindale itself, Tolkien's Overture. So I'd encourage you to check that out if you haven't already. And for those who are interested in this, to go back and look into it. But yeah, you know, it's sometimes with these, with Tolkien's writings, his style could be a little bit convoluted. So sometimes it's hard to pin down the exact sequences and things. So, but I guess the point is the imperishable flame seems to be this thing that gave actual life to various mm-hmm. things, right? Gave it kind of its right. life fire. It gave maybe the soul, right? Is what we call it, is actually animates something. So,
which makes sense because yeah. Tolkien being Catholic
mm-hmm.
and, obviously, you know, infusing that into his work, the Holy Spirit is, you know, the giver of life, right? And mm-hmm. it's often denoted, symbolized as fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that follows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your point about Melkor is definitely interesting, that nothing seems to move until he starts to bring some kind of disturbance. Now, it's hard for me to think that Melkor had to just simply bring, like, you know, had to mess things up in order to make things beautiful and moving. This is one of those very deep existential questions that, you know, that I don't know that we can really arrive at here. And for me, I think you have to read Tolkien's works here through kind of his own beliefs, right? Through his own Catholic beliefs. So, you know, that gets into questions of, are we talking about good and evil in dualistic terms? Or are we talking about evil as a privation of the good, right? As a lesser than the good, mm. right?
Yeah.
And for Tolkien, it would have been the second. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it absolutely has to be read that way, and that Tolkien insisted that it be read that way. But at the same time, he definitely seemed to see within his own works and within these kind of deeper mythologies a reflection of and something that was consistent with the kind of metaphysics of his own universe.
Right.
So
right. Yeah.
Let's finish up Veit's comment here. So he says, moving forward to the Valaquenta, the meaning of the name Melkor, in the original it must be something like he who emerges from power. Isn't that already looking at the bad side of power, similar to the negative consequences of bearing the ring? If you are too powerful, you become corrupted, the antagonist. So Melkor is predestined to be the evil? Interesting, however, that it is Melkor having that name instead of Manwë. Maybe there is some circular reasoning in my interpretation, but maybe you also thought about that sentence and want to share your thoughts briefly. Yeah, you know, again, these are very, very deep existential questions. Whenever you throw predestination out there, things get very heavy and almost inscrutable, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
So... Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to this podcast, I probably back off at that point and just like, you know, we're talking about pretty mysterious questions that people have been arguing about mm-hmm. since really the dawn yeah. of time and especially in the last couple of millennia. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, could Melkor have been good, right? Could Melkor have not chosen evil, right? Maybe the question that we're trying to get to and, yeah. I have to say yes, right? I think it was possible for him to not choose the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it would seem like the evil was a creation itself.
Right. A creation of the good, which is not possible.
Right. Yep. Well, that evil was a creation of Ilúvatar himself.
Right. But Ilúvatar being perfectly good could not create something evil.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, my own views on a philosophical level in this have developed into kind of looking at these sorts of questions and saying that free will and like free beings, right, that have the capability of making free moral choices, that ability is given to us and is a key part of our being made in the image of God, right? And that as a consequence of that, we actually work, we serve to create, participate in creating ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through those actions,
right?
Through those
right.
choices,
yes.
Right? So, I have to think that Melkor was capable of choosing good versus evil. Maybe we just need to do an episode on Melkor
first. Or
maybe a series of episodes on Melkor.
I can't believe we haven't at some point.
Yeah.
Huh. Anyway, yeah, I think we should.
These are all excellent questions, Veit.
And, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know if you've picked up my book yet and read it, but if you haven't, pick up Tolkien's Overture and give it a read. And I'd love to hear more from you after you have a chance to read it. So, because my thoughts had developed more, you know, deeply on Idle and Delay after reading that, and then with Valaquenta as well. All right. Well, I think that we are going to call it an episode with that one.
Oh, all righty, Rudy.
All right.
Let's do it.
By the way, we would love to hear from everybody, as usual. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, through the website, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you can find us. On the next episode, we're going to take a look at 2942 through 3017. This is the period between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of stuff happens during that period.
Good stuff, absolutely.
So, very interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Special thanks to our patrons, especially the following: Shannon S.,
Brian O.,
Emilio P.,
Zeke F.,
James A.,
James L.,
Chris L.,
Chuck F.,
Asya V.,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C.,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D.,
Eric S.,
Joey S.,
Eric B.,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Matt L.,
and Johanna T.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so very much. We'll talk at you next time, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.